are, in comparison with those of the United States, relatively small. Information systems that supply unprecedented detail on the state of financial markets support the ability of financial institutions to rapidly identify abnormal or niche profit opportunities, that is, those whose risk-adjusted rates of return are above normal. Abnormal returns in an essentially unregulated market generally reflect inefficiencies in the flow of the world's saving into capital investment. Heavy purchases of those niche assets restore their pricing to normal. Although certainly not the objective of profit-seeking market participants, the resulting price adjustments, to paraphrase Adam Smith, benefit the world's consumers. High financial profits have attracted a significant array of skilled people and institutions. Most prominent is the reinvigoration of the hedge fund industry. What I remember as a sleepy fringe of finance half a century ago has morphed into a vibrant trillion-dollar industry dominated by U.S. firms. Hedge funds and private equity funds appear to represent the finance of the future, but not just yet. The exceptionally high values the market, that is, consumers indirectly, placed on financial services after the mid-1990s induced many junior partners of investment banking firms to create hedge fund boutiques. As a consequence, the hedge fund market became temporarily surfeited in 2006. Funds were forced into liquidation, as too many new entrants tried to harvest the niche profits they saw their predecessors pick with outstanding success. But what was picked is no longer there. The easy money is mostly gone, and many of those eager would-be hedge fund tycoons saw their large new net worths fall sharply. Few on the outside have shed tears over their plight. Even so, hedge fund investment strategies continue to be instrumental in eliminating abnormal market spreads and presumably much market inefficiency. Indeed, hedge funds have become critical players in world capital markets. They are said to account for a significant share of the volume on the New York Stock Exchange and, more generally, supply much of the liquidity in otherwise stagnant markets. They are essentially free of government regulation, and I hope they will remain so. Imposing a blanket of costly regulation will succeed only in stifling the enthusiasm for seeking niche profits. Hedge funds would disappear or end up as undistinguished, nondescript investment vehicles, and the world's economies would be the worse for it. The marketplace itself regulates hedge funds today through what's known as counterparty surveillance. In other words, constraints are imposed on hedge funds by their high-income investors and the banks and other institutions that lend them money. Protective of their own shareholders, these lenders have incentives to monitor hedge fund investment strategies very closely. As first a bank director at J.P. Morgan and then a bank regulator for 18 years, I was acutely aware of how much better situated and staffed banks were to understand what other banks and hedge funds were doing as compared with the by-the-book regulation done by government financial regulatory agencies. As good as some bank examiners are in promoting sound banking practice, they have little chance of uncovering most fraud or embezzlement without the aid of a whistleblower. A major failure of private counterparty surveillance was the near collapse of long-term capital management, the 1998 financial train wreck described in Chapter 9. LTCM's founders, who included two Nobel Prize winners, were held in such awe that they could and did refuse to offer collateral to their lenders, a fatal concession on the lenders' part. Before long, LTCM ran out of opportunities to earn niche profits, as imitators followed the firm's lead and glutted the market. Instead of returning all, not just some, capital to shareholders and declaring their mission complete, LTCM's principals turned into gamblers, making large bets that had little to do with their original business plan. In 1998, LTCM lost its shirt. The episode shook the market, but it's indicative of the development of this sector and of the financial system generally that when another notable U.S. hedge fund, Amaranth, collapsed in 2006 with a loss of more than $6 billion, the world's financial system registered scarcely a tremor. A recent financial innovation of major importance has been the credit default swap. The CDS, as it is called, is a derivative that transfers the credit risk, usually of a debt instrument, to a third party at a price. Being able to profit from the loan transaction but transfer credit risk is a boom to banks and other financial intermediaries, which, in order to make an adequate rate of return on equity, have to heavily leverage their balance sheets by accepting deposit obligations and/or incurring debt. Most of the time, such institutions lend money and prosper. But in periods of adversity, they typically run into bad debt problems, which in the past had forced them to sharply curtail lending. This, in turn, undermined economic activity more generally. A market vehicle for transferring risk away from these highly leveraged loan originators can be critical for economic stability, especially in a global environment. In response to this need, the CDS was invented and took the market by storm. The Bank for International Settlements tabulated a worldwide notional value of more than $20 trillion equivalent in credit default swaps in mid-2006, up from $6 trillion at the end of 2004. The buffering power of these instruments was vividly demonstrated between 1998 and 2001, when CDSs were used to spread the risk of $1 trillion in loans to rapidly expanding telecommunications networks. Though a large proportion of these ventures defaulted in the tech bust, not a single major lending institution ran into trouble as a consequence. The losses were ultimately borne by highly capitalized institutions, insurers, pension funds, and the like, that had been the major suppliers of the credit default protection. They were well able to absorb the hit. Thus, there was no repetition of the cascading defaults of an earlier era. Regrettably, every time a hedge fund's problems make the news, political pressure to regulate the industry mounts. Hedge funds are both risk takers and very large, the thinking goes. Doesn't that prove they are dangerous? Shouldn't the government rein them in? Leaving aside the undermining of market liquidity that such actions could induce, the benefit of more government regulation eludes me. Hedge funds change their holdings so rapidly that last night's balance sheet is probably of little use by 11 a.m., so regulators would have to scrutinize the funds practically minute by minute. Any governmental restrictions on fund investment behavior, that's what regulation does, would curtail the risk-taking that is integral to the contributions of hedge funds to the global economy, and especially to the economy of the United States. Why do we wish to inhibit the pollinating bees of Wall Street? I say this having served as a regulator myself for 18 years. When I accepted President Reagan's nomination to become chairman of the Fed, what drew me was the challenge of applying what I had learned about the economy and monetary policy over nearly four decades. Yet I knew that the Federal Reserve was also a major bank regulator and the overseer of America's payment systems. Avid defender though I was of letting markets function unencumbered, I knew that as chairman I would also be responsible for the Fed's vast regulatory apparatus. Could I reconcile that duty with my beliefs? In fact, I had crossed that Rubicon long before, during my stint as chairman of President Ford's Council of Economic Advisers. Although the primary job of the CEA was to shoot down harebrained fiscal policy schemes, I did on occasion accept increased regulation, when it appeared to be the least bad of the options politically available to the administration. As Fed chairman, I decided, my personal views on regulation would have to be set aside. After all, I would take an oath of office that would commit me to uphold the Constitution of the United States and those laws whose enforcement falls under the purview of the Federal Reserve. Since I was an outlier in my libertarian opposition to most regulation, I planned to be largely passive in such matters and allow other Federal Reserve governors to take the lead. Taking office, I was in for a pleasant surprise. I had known from my contact with Fed staff members, during the Ford administration especially, how extraordinarily qualified they were. What I had not known about was the staff's free market orientation, which I now discovered characterized even the Division of Bank Supervision and Regulation. Its chief, Bill Taylor, was a likable, thoroughly professional regulator. President Bush, the father, later appointed him to head the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and his premature death in 1992 was a great blow to his colleagues and the nation. So, while the staff recommendations at the Federal Reserve Board were directed to implementing congressional mandates, they were always formulated with a view toward fostering competition and letting markets work. There was less emphasis on "thou shalt not" and more on management accountability and disclosure that would enable markets to function more effectively. The staff also fully recognized the power of counterparty surveillance as the first line of protection against overextended or inappropriate credit. This view of regulation was no doubt influenced by the economists in the institution and on the board. They were generally sensitive to the need to buttress the competitive market forces that the financial safety net of the United States tends to impair. This safety net, which includes such safeguards as deposit insurance, bank access to the Fed's discount facilities, and access to the Fed's vast electronic payments system, reduces the importance of reputation as a constraint on excessive debt creation. Nonetheless, managers' efforts to protect their reputations are important in all businesses, but especially so in banking, where reputation is key to the overall soundness of a bank's operations. If a bank's loan portfolio or its employees are suspect, depositors disappear, often very quickly. But when the deposits are insured in some way, a run is less likely. Studying the damage caused by Depression-era bank runs had led me to conclude that, on balance, deposit insurance is a positive. I had always thought the payment system should be wholly private, but I found that Fedwire, the electronic funds transfer system operated by the Federal Reserve, does offer something no private bank can: riskless final settlements. The Fed's discount window serves as a lender of last resort, a function the private sector cannot provide without impairing a bank shareholder's value. Nonetheless, the presence of a government financial safety net undoubtedly fosters moral hazard, the term used in the insurance business to describe why customers take actions they would not so readily consider were they not insured against the adverse consequences of their behavior. Regulations on lending and deposit taking hence must be carefully designed to minimize the moral hazard they inevitably create. Democracy requires trade-offs. I was delighted that being a regulator was not the burden I had feared. Of the hundreds of board votes on regulation during my tenure, I found myself in the minority just once. I argued that a consumer law requiring disclosure of an interest rate relied on a method of calculation that was faulty, scarcely a major point of philosophical debate. While I never shared the fervor of some for discussing the appropriate wording of a rule, I settled down to a comfortable role in which I asserted myself only on issues that I saw as important to the functioning of the Federal Reserve or to the financial system as a whole. Over the years, I learned a great deal about what kind of regulation produces the least interference. Three rules of thumb. 1. Regulation approved in a crisis must subsequently be fine-tuned. The Sarbanes-Oxley Act, rushed through Congress in the wake of the Enron and WorldCom bankruptcies and mandating greater financial disclosure by corporations, is today's prime candidate for revision. 2. Sometimes several regulators are better than one. The solitary regulator becomes risk-averse. He or she tries to guard against all imaginable negative outcomes, creating a crushing compliance burden. In the financial industries, where the Fed shares regulatory jurisdiction with the Comptroller of the Currency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and other authorities, we tended to keep one another in check. 3. Regulations outlive their usefulness and should be renewed periodically. I learned this lesson watching Virgil Mattingly, the longtime chief of the Federal Reserve Board's legal staff. He took very seriously the statutory requirement to review each Federal Reserve regulation every 5 years. Any regulation that was judged to be obsolete was unceremoniously scrapped. An area in which more rather than less government involvement is needed, in my judgment, is the rooting out of fraud. It is the bane of any market system. Fraud is a destroyer of the market process itself, because market participants need to rely on the veracity of other market participants. Indeed, Washington would do well to divert resources from creating new regulations to greatly stepping up the enforcement of anti-fraud and anti-racketeering laws. It is not uncommon to see legislators and regulators rush to promulgate new laws and rules in response to market breakdowns, and the mistakes that result often take decades to correct. I had long argued that the Glass-Steagall Act, which in 1933 separated the business of securities underwriting from commercial banking, was based on faulty history. Testimony before Congress in 1933 was filled with anecdotes that gave the impression that inappropriate use by banks of their securities affiliates was undermining overall soundness. Only after World War II, when computers made it possible to evaluate the banking system as a whole, did it become evident that banks with securities affiliates had weathered the 1930s crisis better than those without affiliates. A few months before I took up my duties at the Fed, the board introduced a proposal that would again allow banks to sell securities through affiliates under very restrictive conditions. The board continued to encourage easing of the restrictions, and I testified many times for legislative change. It took until 1999 for Glass-Steagall to be repealed by the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. Fortunately, Graham-Leach-Bliley, which restored sorely needed flexibility to the financial industries, is no aberration. Awareness of the detrimental effects of excessive regulation and the need for economic adaptability has advanced substantially in recent years. We dare not go back. Globalization, the extension of capitalism to world markets, like capitalism itself, is the object of intense criticism from those who see only the destructive side of creative destruction. Yet all credible evidence indicates that the benefits of globalization far exceed its costs, even beyond the realm of economics. For example, economist Barry Eichengreen and political scientist David LeBlanc, in a paper delivered in late 2006, found evidence during the 130-year span from 1870 to 2000 of positive relationships running in both directions between globalization and democracy. They found that trade openness promotes democracy. The impact of financial openness on democracy is not as strong, but still points in the same direction, and democracies are more likely to remove capital controls. Accordingly, we should focus on addressing and assuaging the fears induced by the dark side of creative destruction, rather than imposing limits on the economic edifice on which worldwide prosperity depends. Innovation is as important to our global financial marketplace as it is to technology, consumer products, or healthcare. As globalization expands and ultimately begins to slow, our financial system will need to retain its flexibility. Protectionism, whatever its guise, whether political or economic, whether it affects trade or finance, is a prescription for economic stagnation and political authoritarianism. We can do better than that. Indeed, we must. Chapter 20. The Conundrum. "What is going on?" I complained in June 2004 to Vincent Reinhardt, director of the Division of Monetary Affairs at the Federal Reserve Board. I was perturbed because we had increased the federal funds rate, and not only had yields on 10-year Treasury notes failed to rise, they'd actually declined. It was a pattern we were accustomed to seeing only late in a credit tightening cycle, when long-term interest rates began to fully reflect the lowered inflationary expectations that were the consequence of the Fed tightening. More typical was the pattern of long-term interest rates in 1994, for example. In February and the ensuing months, we raised the federal funds rate a total of 175 basis points with the aim of diffusing an incipient rise in inflation expectations. The yield on the Treasury long-term note rose. Only at the end of 1994, after we raised the federal funds rate an additional 75 basis points, did the yield decline. Seeing yields decline at the beginning of a tightening cycle was extremely unusual. This tightening cycle had barely even begun. I'd signaled its commencement less than 2 months earlier, when in testimony before the Joint Economic Committee of Congress, I delivered a clear signal of the Fed's intention to raise rates. The federal funds rate must rise at some point to prevent pressures on price inflation from eventually emerging. The Federal Reserve recognizes that sustained prosperity requires the maintenance of price stability and will act as necessary to ensure that outcome. Our hope was to raise mortgage rates to levels that would diffuse the boom in housing, which by then was producing an unwelcome froth. The response from the market was immediate. Anticipating the increase in bond yields usually associated with an initial rise in the federal funds rate, market participants built large short positions in long-term debt instruments. Yields on 10-year Treasury notes rose about 1 percentage point during the next several weeks. Our tightening program seemed to be right on track. But by June, market pressures, seemingly coming out of nowhere, drove long-term rates back down. Thinking we must be witnessing an aberration, I was both perplexed and intrigued. Unexplainable market episodes are something Fed policymakers have to deal with all the time. On many an occasion, I have been able to ferret out the causes of some peculiarity in market pricing after a month or two of watching the anomaly play out. On other occasions, the aberration has remained a mystery. Price changes, of course, result from a shift in balance between supply and demand. But analysts can observe only the price consequences of the shift. Short of psychoanalyzing all market participants to determine what led them to act as they did, we may never be able to explain certain episodes. The stock market crash of October 1987 is one such instance. To this day, there are competing hypotheses about what set off that record one-day plunge. The explanations range from strained relations with Germany to high interest rates. We certainly experienced the fact that there were more sellers than buyers, but nobody really knows why. I did not come up with an explanation for the 2004 episode, and I decided that it must be just another odd passing event not to be repeated. I was mistaken. In February and March of 2005, the anomaly cropped up again. Reacting to continued Fed tightening, long-term rates again began to rise, but just as in 2004, market forces came into play to render those increases short-lived. What were those market forces? They were surely global, because the declines in long-term interest rates during that period were at least as pronounced in major foreign financial markets as they were in the United States. Globalization, of course, had been a prominent disinflationary force since the mid-1980s. I was still intrigued by the vast pattern of change that I'd sketched out for my colleagues on the FOMC in December 1995, telling them, "It is very difficult to find inflationary forces anywhere in the world. Something different is going on." At that point, I couldn't yet prove it, but I explained what I thought was the answer. You may recall that earlier this year, I raised the issue of the extraordinary impact of accelerating technologies, largely silicon-based technologies, on the turnover of capital stock, the fairly dramatic decline in the average age of the stock, and the creation as a consequence of a high degree of insecurity for those individuals in the labor markets who have to deal with continually changing technological apparatus. One example that I think brings this development close to home, even though it is an unrealistic example, is how secretaries would feel if the location of the keys on their typewriters were changed every 2 years. We are, in effect, doing that to the overall workforce. To my mind, this increasingly explains why wage patterns have been as restrained as they have been. One extraordinary piece of recent evidence is an unprecedented number of labor contracts with 5 or 6 year maturities. We never had a labor contract of more than 3 years duration in the last 30 to 40 years. The underlying technology changes that support this hypothesis appear only once every century, or 50 years. In addition, the downsizing of products as a consequence of computer chip technologies has created a significant decline in implicit transportation costs. We are producing very small products that are cheaper to move. Equally important is the dramatic effect of telecommunications technology in reducing the cost of communications. As the downsized products have spread and the cost of communications has fallen, the globe has become increasingly smaller. We are now seeing the proliferation of outsourcing ever increasingly around the globe. What one would expect to see as this occurs, and indeed it is happening, is the combination of rising capital efficiency and falling nominal unit labor costs. This is a new phenomenon, and it raises interesting questions as to whether, in fact, there is something more profoundly important going on for the longer run. We could not be sure of the appropriate assessment of our changing world for probably 5 to 10 years, I told them. But the passage of time only brought the phenomenon of worldwide disinflation into sharper relief. With the new millennium, signs of it became increasingly evident, even among developing countries whose histories were rife with inflationary episodes. Mexico in 2003 was proudly able to market a first-time-ever 20-year peso-denominated bond, only 8 years after the nation faced a severe liquidity crisis in which the government could not find buyers for even short-term dollar-denominated debt and required a U.S.-led bailout. Admittedly, Mexico had taken a number of important steps to get its fiscal and monetary house in order following its 1995 near default. But there was nothing in those steps to suggest that it would quickly gain the ability to sell a relatively low-yield 20-year peso-denominated bond. Mexico's checkered macroeconomic history had hitherto required long-term debt issues to be denominated in foreign currencies in order to attract investors. Mexico was not an isolated case. governments of other developing countries were increasingly issuing long-term debt in their own currencies at interest rates that developed countries would gladly have welcomed only a decade earlier. And I've noted Brazil, contrary to previous experience, had been able to absorb a 40% devaluation of its currency in 2002 with only short-term and relatively modest inflationary consequences. Inflation had been subdued virtually across the globe. Inflation expectations, reflected in long-term debt yields, plunged. The yields on developing nations' debt shrank to unprecedented lows. Double and sometimes triple-digit annual inflation rates, historically a hallmark of developing economies, had, with a few exceptions, disappeared. Episodes of hyperinflation became extremely rare. Zimbabwe, which has mangled its economy, has been the principal exception. Developing countries averaged an annual increase of 50% in consumer prices between 1989 and 1998. By 2006, consumer price inflation had fallen to less than 5%. But even though globalization had reduced long-term interest rates, in the summer of 2004, we had no reason to expect that a Fed tightening would not carry long-term rates up with it. We anticipated that we would just be starting from a lower long-term rate than was customary in the past. The unprecedented response to the Federal Reserve's monetary tightening that year suggested that in addition to globalization, profoundly important forces had developed whose full significance was only now emerging. I was stumped. I called the historically unprecedented state of affairs a conundrum. My puzzlement was not assuaged by the numerous bottles of conundrum label wine arriving at my office. I don't recall the vintage. A little-noticed event in Europe offered the first clue to unraveling the new puzzle. Siemens, one of Germany's formidable exporters, had informed its union, IG Metall, in 2004 that unless the union agreed to a pay cut of more than 12% at two plants, Siemens would contemplate relocating the facilities to Eastern Europe. Boxed in, IG Metall acquiesced, and the exodus of Siemens plants to the newly freed economies of Eastern Europe was stayed. In September 2006, Volkswagen negotiated a similar agreement to lower average hourly earnings in exchange for securing jobs threatened by plant relocation. This event struck a chord for me because I had seen reports of similar confrontations earlier. It led me to review the pattern of wage increases in Germany. Employers had long been complaining that high wages were making them uncompetitive, even though average hourly compensation had not been rising very fast, at an annual rate of 2.3% between 1995 and 2002. Their message was obviously now finally getting through. Starting in late 2002, hourly labor cost growth was abruptly cut to half that rate, and it stayed very low through the end of 2006. Siemens and the rest of German industry, assisted by reforms allowing wider use of so-called temporary workers, were able to damp German wages, costs, and hence prices. Inflation expectations declined with the decline in the recorded rate of inflation. IG Metall's loss of bargaining power, of course, was wholly the result of forces outside German borders, the entrance on the competitive scene of at least 150 million low-priced, well-educated workers released from the grip of the Soviet Empire's centrally planned economic system. The end of the Cold War, the stand-down from the brink of war by the world's two nuclear superpowers, has little to challenge it as the second half of the century's most significant geopolitical event. The economic significance of the demise of the Soviet Union has been awesome in its own right, as I noted in Chapter 6. The fall of the Berlin Wall exposed a state of economic ruin so devastating that central planning, earlier applauded as a scientific substitute for the chaos of the marketplace, fell into terminal disrepute. There was no eulogy or economic postmortem. It just disappeared, without a whimper, from political and economic discourse. As a consequence, communist China, which had discovered the practical virtues of markets a decade earlier, accelerated its march toward free market capitalism without, of course, ever acknowledging that that was what it was doing. India began to awaken from the bureaucratic socialism of former Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru, and any notions emerging economies might have had of implementing or expanding economy-wide forms of central planning were quietly shelved. Soon, well over 1 billion workers, many well-educated, all low-paid, began to gravitate to the world competitive marketplace from economies that had been almost wholly or in part centrally planned and insulated from global competition. The IMF estimates that in 2005, more than 800 million members of the world's labor force were engaged in export-oriented and therefore competitive markets, an increase of 500 million since the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and 600 million since 1980, with East Asia accounting for half of the increase. Lesser numbers in Eastern Europe moved from behind the protections of centrally planned regimes to domestic competitive markets. Many hundreds of millions of people, mainly in China and India, have yet to make the transition. This movement of workers into the marketplace reduced world wages, inflation, inflation expectations, and interest rates, and accordingly significantly contributed to rising world economic growth. Even though the aggregate payroll of the newly repositioned workforce was only a fraction of that of developed nations, the impact was pronounced. Not only did low-priced imports displace production and hence workers in developed countries, but the competitive effect of the displaced workers seeking new jobs suppressed the wages of workers not directly in the line of fire of low-priced imports. In addition, migration from Eastern to Western Europe of low-priced workers exposed part of the homegrown workforces of Western Europe to enhanced wage competition. Finally, exports from previously centrally planned economies competitively suppressed export prices of all economies. Had these billion-plus low-cost workers arrived in world labor markets en masse overnight, I do not doubt that chaos would have ensued. The Soviet-dominated economies of Eastern Europe made the transition in a decade, but scarcely smoothly. However, they represented only a fraction of the potential tectonic shift. Most dominant by far has been China, where labor force data, to the extent they can be relied upon, suggest a slow but gradually accelerating government-controlled shift of the workforce of the rural provinces to the dynamic, market-dominated regions of the Pearl River Delta and other export-oriented areas. Vast numbers of Chinese workers left agriculture-related pursuits for manufacturing and service jobs in urban areas. Privately controlled businesses rose to claim a significant share of China's near 800 million person workforce. By 2006, agriculture was down to little more than two-fifths of total employment. Chinese manufacturing employment has held steady in recent years, despite massive workforce reductions in state-owned enterprises. The largest gains in employment over the last decade have been in services. Importantly, it is the rate of change of movement from centrally planned employment to competitive markets that determines the degree of disinflationary pressure on developed nations' wage costs and hence prices. Because of the indirect effects of competitive imports and immigration, the addition of new low-priced workers affects the whole structure of labor costs in developed countries. The greater the rate of worker additions to the competitive market, the greater the downward pressure on developed countries' wage costs and prices. The initial overall impact was perhaps a reduction of only a couple of percentage points of annual wage growth at best. That major systemic effects could stem from such an apparently modest initial impact may seem like a man lifting a ton of steel. But if he has a lever, he can. The trajectory of growth has been altered, engendering a circle of lessened wage costs leading to lesser inflation expectations, which in turn further depress wage growth and put a brake on price increases. China is by far the dominant contributor to the trend. Over the past quarter century, the rising rate of worker migration to the export-oriented coastal provinces imparted an ever-increasing degree of wage and price disinflation to the developed economies. But this also suggests that once the shift of erstwhile centrally planned workers, desirous and capable of competing in world markets, is complete, the downward pressure on developed countries' wage rates and prices, at least from this global source, will cease. In 2000, half of China's workforce was still employed in primary industry, mostly in agriculture. South Korea had reached that level in 1970 on the way down. Today, primary industry employment in China is roughly 45%, and in South Korea it is under 8%. If China were to follow South Korea's historic path over the next quarter century, its rate of internal migration, which is still rising, would not peak for another several years. But the quality of the data, both South Korea's in earlier years and China's today, limits the clarity with which we can gauge changing rates of migration. Moreover, given the differences between today's China and the South Korea of a quarter century earlier with respect to size, political orientation, and economic policies, analogies can be only suggestive. The critical time for the world economic outlook and for policymakers will not be when the shifting of workers comes to an end, but when its rate of increase starts to slow. We know it must slow, since at some point, however distant, the transition to competitive markets will be complete. As the rate of worker flows peaks, the disinflationary effects will start to lift and higher inflation pressures will emerge. That turning point may well be several years in the future, as the Korean analogy suggests. But early evidence that such a process is underway would enlist the increasingly anticipatory aspects of global finance to bring the market-turning date forward, possibly to 3 years or less. While the marked reduction in inflation and inflation expectations after the fall of the Berlin Wall lowered inflation premiums embodied in long-term debt issues worldwide, its effect on real interest rates has been limited to the lowered risk premiums resulting from the reduced market volatility that lower inflation fosters. The rest of the decline in real interest rates appears to be the result of a significant increase in the world's average effective propensity to save relative to its propensity to invest those savings in productive assets. Excess potential savings flooded global financial markets, driving real interest rates lower. But this too appears to be the consequence of the post-Soviet shift to competitive markets among developing countries and their resulting surge in growth. Global investments in plant, equipment, inventories, and homes must always be equal to global savings, the net means of financing these investments. Every asset must have an owner. The market value of paper claims against newly created capital assets must equal the market value of those assets. In a sense, the world's checkbook must balance. Savings must equal investment for the world as a whole. But businesses and households plan their investments before they can know which savers in the world will ultimately finance them. And the world's savers plan their savings before they know what investments they will finance. Accordingly, the intended investment for any period almost never equals intended saving. When both investors and savers try to achieve their intentions in the marketplace, any imbalance forces real interest rates to change until actual investment and actual savings are brought into equality. If intended investment exceeds intended savings, real interest rates will rise enough to dissuade investors from investing and/or persuade savers to save more. If intended savings exceeds intended investment, real interest rates will fall. Outside the textbooks, this process is not sequential, but concurrent and instantaneous. We never observe actual global investment as different from actual global savings. Despite their lower incomes, households and businesses in developing countries save greater shares of their income than do households and businesses in developed countries. Developed countries have vast financial networks that lend to consumers and businesses, most often backed by collateral, enabling a significant fraction to spend beyond their current incomes. Far fewer such financial networks exist in developing nations to entice people to spend beyond their incomes. Moreover, most developing nations are still so close to bare subsistence that households need to insure against future contingencies. They seek a buffer against feared destitution, and since few of these countries have government safety nets adequate to protect against adversity, the only way for the households to do so is to set money aside. People are forced to save for a rainy day and retirement. One of my earliest statistical analyses for the National Industrial Conference Board, more than half a century ago, showed that American farmers, despite lower average incomes, saved a larger share of their income than did city dwellers. Urban incomes were not subject to the vagaries of weather that afflicted almost all farm families in those days. Note that back then, farmers' peer groups were other farmers, and hence urban spending patterns had not fully infiltrated the farm community. As reported to the IMF, savings as a percentage of nominal GDP for advanced economies, that is, developed nations, during the 1980s and 1990s, tended to hover in the vicinity of 21% to 22%. Developing countries averaged 23% to 24% over those decades. But starting in 2000, the developing world's embrace of competitive markets and capitalist practices finally began to pay off. Foreign direct investment to employ a low-paid domestic workforce encouraged by increasingly credible property rights began to accelerate export-led growth. Foreign direct investment in China, as I've noted, rose gradually from 1980 to 1990, but then rose 17-fold by 2006, as the evidence that market capitalism was the most effective force for prosperity became widespread. Whether rightly or wrongly, foreign investors must have believed that lesson had been absorbed by Chinese governing authorities and was being implemented in their sometimes ambiguous rule of law. During the past 5 years, developing country growth has been twice that of developed countries. Their savings rates, led by China, rose from 24% in 2001 to 32% in 2006 as consumption in these culturally conservative societies lagged and investment fell far short of the rise in savings. Savings rates in the developed world have slipped below 20% since 2002. World investment has risen very modestly as a percentage of GDP, almost wholly in developing countries. A minor problem in doing such an evaluation is that recorded world savings and investment are separated by a statistical discrepancy. Oil-exporting countries chose to spend only a modest share of their increased revenues on new oil-productive capacity. Economists, of course, can measure savings, but since saving intentions are rarely recorded anywhere, estimates of intentions are little better than an informed guess. However, it is not unreasonable to surmise that world intended savings has exceeded intended investment in recent years, as evidenced by the worldwide decline in real long-term interest rates, that is, those adjusted for inflation expectations. Even with no change in intended savings behavior by anyone, the growing share of world incomes accruing to developing economies with chronically higher savings rates would move intended world savings persistently higher year after year. And that trend would continue as long as developing economy growth rates exceeded those of developed economies, as they have since 2000. Ordinarily, when real interest rates fall, economists have difficulty determining whether it was a rise in intended savings or a fall in intended investment that was the proximate cause. But the surge in developing country savings, only half of which was invested in the developing world, suggests strongly that it was the spillover of developing countries' savings that drove real interest rates lower. Since actual recorded developed country investment rose only modestly, driven by lower rates, intended investment in the developed world must have been stable or close to it as a share of GDP. In fact, as I note in Chapter 25, intended investment in the United States has been lagging in recent years, judging from the larger share of internal corporate cash flow that has been returned to shareholders, presumably for lack of new investment opportunities. These data are consistent with the notion that this decade's decline in long-term interest rates, both nominal and real, is mainly the effect of geopolitical forces rather than that of the normal play of market forces. If developing countries continue to grow at a rapid rate, and financial networks expand to lend more readily to the increasing number of citizens with rising discretionary incomes, developing country savings rates are bound to fall, at least back to 1980s and 1990s levels. The inbred human desire to keep up with the Joneses is already manifest in the nascent consumer markets of the developing world. Increases in consumption would tend to remove the downward pressure of excess savings on real interest rates, provided, of course, that intended investment as a share of GDP does not fall in tandem. But that would likely occur even if the rate of growth of developing country incomes should slow. In all economies, spending rarely keeps up with unexpected surges in income, hence savings rates rise. As income growth slows back to trend, savings rates tend to fall. So, as erstwhile centrally planned workforces complete their transition to competitive markets, and as developing countries' increasingly sophisticated financial systems facilitate the inbred propensity toward higher consumption and less saving, inflation, inflation premiums, and interest rates will gradually lose their disinflation buffer of the past decade. I will address the timing of these events in the final chapter. The ability of developing economies to continue to grow faster than developed economies will fade unless developing nations can supplement their borrowed technology with new insights and innovations from their scientists and high-tech engineers. New ones are currently being schooled in China, India, and elsewhere in the technologies of the past century developed in the West. Some could reasonably be expected to move beyond the technological levels of developed economies. But more important to economic growth, and perhaps even a necessary condition for the technology of China, India, or Russia to move beyond that of, say, the United States, is political certainty. How much is America's political system, its protection of individual rights, especially property rights, and its relatively low degree of regulation and low incidence of corruption, contributed to the gap between standards of living of U.S. residents and those of developing countries? I suspect a great deal. However, although we may have world-class universities, our primary and secondary education system, as I note in Chapter 21, is deeply deficient in providing homegrown talent to operate our increasingly complex infrastructure, which pours out levels of goods and services that no country has been able to match. Citizens of developing countries, unable to find adequate risk-adjusted rates of return at home, invest in the United States, where, for more than two centuries, property rights of all, U.S. citizens and foreigners, have received firm and equal protection under the law. Few developing countries protect the property rights of even their own citizens as we do the property rights of foreigners. When I say risk-adjusted rates of return, I'm referring to the degree of risk in developing countries, and in a number of developed countries as well, of outright confiscation of investments, or its equivalent in the form of deadening regulation, capricious taxation, spotty enforcement of laws, or rampant corruption. The point I wish to emphasize is that any proper measure of the degree of property rights in a country must encompass such factors as regulation and arbitrariness in the enforcement of laws. Corruption, in addition, drives up the cost of ownership. Most developing countries rate poorly on all these counts. In fact, a major reason they remain developing and find it difficult to graduate to developed is their low scores on property rights enforcement. The United States ranks high. Its political risk premiums are among the lowest in the world. However, America's reputation has been somewhat diminished by the thwarting of high-profile foreign acquisitions of Unocal by a Chinese company in 2005 and of a company that managed U.S. ports by Dubai Ports World in 2006. I can readily imagine the technology knowledge gap between developed and developing economies narrowing significantly. However, I find it difficult to foresee so marked a short-term change in China's authoritarianism, India's smothering bureaucracy, or Russia's erratic enforcement of property rights. In fact, investor perception of such political risk changes so slowly that it would likely be years following any fundamental and credible changes before such risks were largely excised from economic decision-making. I have always thought that measured inflation at a rate as low as 1% cannot be sustained in an economy using a fiat currency in a competitively democratic society with any remnant of populism. Is any country immune? Given the upward bias of measured prices, a 1% reported rate of price increase probably represents an economy with price stability. Such a currency, by its very nature, has as the only constraint on its supply the actions of the central bank, and cannot be entirely insulated from political influences. The U.S. inflations of 1946, 1950, and the late 1970s remain too vivid in my memory. I had that view challenged in 2003 by the Japanese deflation, though in the end, deflation in the United States did not take hold. If a typical inflation rate of a democratically mandated fiat currency is north of 1-2%, what force could keep inflation below that mark as the two major disinflationary forces that I have discussed in this chapter recede? The most obvious answer is monetary policy. There will come a point at which central bankers, as I note in Chapter 25, will be pressed once again to contain inflationary pressures. Central bankers over the past several decades have absorbed an important principle. Price stability is the path to maximum sustainable economic growth. Many economists, in fact, credit central bank monetary policy as the key factor in the last decade's reduction in inflation worldwide. I would like to believe that. I do not deny that we adjusted policy to be consonant with global disinflationary trends as they emerged. but I very much doubt that either policy actions or central bank anti-inflationary credibility played the leading role in the fall of long-term interest rates in the past 1 to 2 decades. That decline, and the conundrum, can be accounted for by forces other than monetary policy. In fact, during my experience since the mid-1990s with the interaction between the policies of the world's central banks and the financial markets, I was struck by how relatively easy it was to bring inflation down. The inflationary pressures of which I was so acutely aware in the late 1980s were largely absent, or more accurately, dormant. The conundrum exposed this point. To judge success in containing inflation, central banks look to changes in inflation expectations implicit in nominal long-term interest rates. Success is evident when long-term rates slip in the face of aggressive monetary tightening. But as I recall, during most of our initiatives to confront rising inflation pressures, aggressive tightening was unnecessary. Even a slight tap on the brake induced long-term rates to decline. It seemed too easy, a far cry from the monetary policy crises of the 1970s. The 10-year Treasury note yielded 8.7% on the day I was sworn in as Fed chairman and rose to 10.2% by Black Monday. The yield on the 10-year note then proceeded to fall for the next 16 years, seemingly irrespective of the Fed's policy stance. I often wondered how much we would need to raise the federal funds rate to move the 10-year note higher for a sustained period. Countering huge global financial flows would have been a formidable task so long as international forces drove inflation expectations and real long-term interest rates lower and pressed stock and real estate prices higher. The forces driving the 10-year note appeared increasingly global. The best policy under such circumstances is to go with the flow, to calibrate monetary policy so that it is consistent with global forces. We did that. During the global financial transformation that confronted the Fed when I was chairman, our strategy was effective in that we understood what policies were most consistent with the stability of American financial markets. I doubt that we had the resources to counter the downward pressures on real long-term interest rates, which were becoming increasingly global. Certainly Japan did not. The pervasive body of recent experience showing how effectively stable prices contribute to economic growth and standards of living will be a major incentive for world central bankers to contain inflationary pressures in the future. As I put it at a congressional hearing a few years ago, monetary policy should make even a fiat money economy behave as though anchored by gold. Is it possible that the world has permanently learned the benefits of stable prices for economic growth and standards of living and will maintain policies that sustain them? I will address this question in Chapter 25. Chapter 21. Education and Income Inequality. Despite an impressive 5 years of above-average economic growth that drove the unemployment rate well below 5%, a majority of Americans in 2006 reported significant dissatisfaction with the state of the economy. There has been a sense in middle-income America that in recent years, prosperity's economic rewards have not been distributed fairly. And indeed, though fairness is in the eye of the beholder, it is true that income concentration has been rising since 1980. The standard measure of concentration of household income, for example, the Gini coefficient, rose steadily between 1980 and 2005, from 0.403 to 0.469. Polls give each respondent equal weight, and there are far more lower and middle income earners who are doing poorly than upper income earners who are doing well. The mood of a significant proportion of those answering pollsters' questions is disturbingly sour. The danger is that populist politicians, catering to such a mood, can marshal unexpected majorities in the Congress for short-sighted, counterproductive actions that could turn a state of bad feelings into a truly serious economic crisis. Overshadowing the current anxiety is a problem of longer standing. Many people's day-by-day experiences in the job market seem to contradict the well-documented evidence that competitive markets over the decades have elevated standards of living for the vast majority of Americans and much of the rest of the world. Too many perceive the increasingly competitive markets that are the hallmark of today's high-tech globalized economy as continuously destroying jobs, and those losses are all too visible. Large layoffs are publicized in the media. reductions in job slots in America's factories and offices appear unending. It is thus not surprising that competition is often seen as a threat to job security. It is not perceived as a creator of higher wages either, although in the end it always has been and inevitably will be now as well. In the decades since World War II, real wages have risen as competitive markets have moved the capital and workers employed in obsolescent, low-productivity facilities to the new, more technology-intensive, and thus more productive means in turning out the nation's GDP. Consequently, as the economic pie became larger, rewards to both capital and labor increased, and competitive forces have tended to keep shares of national income accruing to employee compensation and profits relatively trendless over the decades. The profit share tends to rise and the employee share to decline in the initial stages of a business cycle and to reverse thereafter. And in fact, if we look at the last decade or two, we can see that the net result is that the distribution of shares of national income between capital and labor has not been much different from their distribution in the past half century. This means that trends in real compensation per hour have tracked output per hour, that is, productivity, closely since the end of World War II, which in turn implies that the distribution between labor compensation on the one hand and profits of the gains from productivity improvements on the other has been stable. If real labor income is a fixed share of real national income, or GDP, then L equals A times Y, where L equals real labor income and Y equals real GDP, with A being labor's share of GDP. L equals W times H, where W is the real wage and H is the number of hours worked. Since W times H equals A times Y, then W equals A times Y over H, where Y over H equals real output per hour. Thus, if over the long run labor share is fixed, the real wage must be proportional to output per hour. All this says little, however, about the distribution of labor compensation itself, which includes the income of factory workers, other non-supervisory workers, and corporate executives, among others. It is not particularly comforting to a worker on the factory floor when his or her wage goes up minimally, while the company's CEO gets a multimillion-dollar bonus. The distribution of labor compensation is driven by a different set of competitive forces that govern the supply and demand for relative skills. For the past decade, I have been tracking average hourly wages and salaries for the 4/5 of our non-farm workforce who are production or non-supervisory workers relative to the 1/5 who are supervisory employees, including skilled professionals and managers. In the spring of 2007, the supervisory workforce had average hourly salaries of approximately $59 per hour, compared with $17 per hour for the non-supervisory employees. That means that 1/5 of the total number of employed Americans earned 46% of total wages and salaries. In 1997, that percentage was 41%. The numbers are estimated matching Bureau of Labor Statistics data on payroll employment, supervisory versus non-supervisory, average hourly earnings of non-supervisory workers, and total wages and salaries including bonuses and exercise of stock option grants estimated by the Department of Commerce from quarterly reports submitted to the Department of Labor by almost all employers. The rise has been persistent over the decade. Average hourly earnings of production workers went up 3.4% annually, while supervisory workers' hourly earnings rose 5.6%. Americans have generally been comfortable with high incomes from efforts that demonstrably contribute to the economic well-being of the nation and are thus clearly earned. Although the notion of what is earned and not earned is open to interpretation, people do not seem shy about drawing conclusions. In recent years, for example, the American electorate and their representatives in Washington have been decidedly less tolerant of the dramatic rise in corporate executive compensation, an issue I will address in Chapter 23. The complex set of market forces by which the nation's output is distributed as income to the various creators of GDP is barely visible to the average American. It does no good to argue that unrestrained competition leaves a society, on average, better off, when in recent years workers see their bosses gaining large bonuses as they themselves get tepid wage increases. People have to experience competition's advantages firsthand. If they do not, some will turn to populist leaders who promise, for example, to erect tariff walls. Such protectionism is perceived, erroneously, as securing high-paying jobs in steel, autos, textiles, and chemicals, the icons of America's past economic might. But 21st-century consumers are less disposed to the products of those industries than were their parents. The U.S. domestic economy, by implication, will no longer support the relative wages and job levels contracted in those industries during negotiations of an earlier period. Accordingly, steel and textile industry employment is off sharply from the peaks of the 1950s and 1960s. The declines will likely continue. The loss of traditional manufacturing jobs in the United States is often considered a worrisome hollowing out of the economy. It is not. On the contrary, the shift of manufacturing jobs in steel, autos, and textiles, for example, to their more modern equivalents in computers, telecommunications, and information technology is a plus, not a minus, to the American standard of living. Traditional manufacturing companies are no longer the symbol of cutting-edge technologies. Their roots lie deep in the 19th century or earlier. The world's consumers have increasingly been drawn to products embodying new ideas, cell phones over bicycles, for example. Global trade gives us access to a full range of products without requiring us to manufacture all of them domestically. Were we to bow to the wishes of the economically uninformed and erect barriers to foreign trade, the pace of competition would surely slow, and tensions, I suppose, might at first appear to ease. After all, Richard Nixon's wage and price controls were highly popular when they were imposed in August 1971. The euphoria dissipated quickly as shortages began to appear. It is likely that such a scenario of growing discontent would be repeated were tariff walls raised. The American standard of living would soon begin to stagnate and even decline as a consequence of rising prices, deteriorating product choice, and, perhaps most visibly, our trading partners retaliating by shutting out our job-creating exports. Manufacturing jobs can no longer be highly paid, since it is consumers who at the end of the day pay the wages of factory workers. And they have balked. They prefer Walmart prices. Those prices, reflecting Chinese low wages, are inconsistent with the funding of high-wage traditional U.S. factories. Forcing U.S. consumers to pay above-market prices to support factory salaries eventually would run into severe resistance. But by then, the American standard of living would have fallen. The Peterson Institute of International Economics estimates that the cumulative effect of globalization since the end of World War II has added 10% to the level of the GDP of the United States. Shutting our doors to trade would bring the American standard of living down by that percentage. By comparison, the hugely painful retrenchment in real GDP from the third quarter of 1981 to the third quarter of 1982 was only 1.4%. Those who say it is better that fewer people experience the stress of globalization, even if it means that some people are less wealthy, are creating a false choice. Once walled off, a country loses its competitive verve and begins to stagnate, and stagnation leads to even more intense pain for more people. If these dire outcomes are unacceptable, as I trust they are, what can be done to counter the distorted perception of how jobs are gained and lost and how incomes are generated? And how can we redress the reality of the continuing advance of income inequality? Both are, among other considerations, undermining support for competitive markets. As I have noted many times, competitive markets and, by extension, globalization and capitalism cannot be sustained without the support of a large proportion of society. The rule of law under which capitalist economic institutions function must be perceived as fair if these institutions are to continue to receive broad support. The only way to temper the bias against an economy that entails the timely repositioning of labor is to continue to support market incentives that create jobs and to find productive ways to ease the pain of job losers. That problem is not new. The growing inequality of income, however, is new, and it requires analysis as to its roots and policy action where appropriate. The Beatles did well in Britain, but they did spectacularly well when they gained access to the world market and reaped the benefits of vast audiences and record sales far beyond what was available to them at home. Nobody complained about globalization, nor has anyone complained about Roger Federer's good fortune. His tennis skills would have earned him little if he had been confined to his native Switzerland. Businesses, of course, also gain large advantages when they become able to reach beyond their sovereign borders, advantages that they pass on in part to domestic customers through lower prices and in part to their shareholders. As economists would say, their marginal cost of going global is a very small fraction of their added worldwide revenues. Cross-border trade assists in recovering domestic sunk fixed costs, especially research and development. Boeing and Airbus, for example, would not have developed so many different types of aircraft if their markets were limited to sales in their own countries. Until quite recently, judging from the numerous rounds of successful trade negotiations, globalization has been generally accepted. There is little doubt, however, that, driven by rapidly expanding innovation and competition, globalization has been a major contributor to the increasing concentration of income virtually everywhere. In the past couple of decades, innovation, especially internet-related, has been moving faster than we can educate ourselves to apply advancing technologies. Thus, the shortfall of the supply of advanced skills relative to the demand for them is pressing the wages of skilled workers higher relative to the wages of the less skilled. There is no compelling reason why the pace of innovative ideas, which often come in bunches, should be immediately matched by a supply of skilled workers to implement them. The insights that advance cutting-edge technologies emerge from a very small part of that workforce. As globalization increased the skilled wage premium, technological innovation was also taking a toll on lesser-skilled workers. The demand for moderately skilled workers declined as repetitive jobs were gradually displaced by computer programs. I recall architectural and engineering firms with acres of people drawing detailed designs for the newest building complex or jet aircraft. Those jobs are all gone, programmed out of existence. Lower-income workers, mainly in services not subject to global competition, have fared somewhat better. Fears of Americans that immigration is undercutting their wage levels have yet to be confirmed by hard evidence. In general, lower-income U.S. workers did poorly in the 1980s, but have fared somewhat better in recent years.